From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in April of 2014 in Ukraine. Demonstrations by pro-Russian groups got heated, and that led to armed conflict in eastern Ukraine. On one side, the Ukrainian government. On the other, separatist forces that were backed by Russia. Vladimir Putin denied involvement at the time and still insists that he did not send regular troops. But many organizations and international observers have confirmed that Russian military vehicles crossed the border, joining the fighting, and helping defeat Ukrainian forces, at least in September of 2014. Now, what was and what is Vladimir Putin really up to? What does he want? We asked the same questions when Putin went after Crimea. What is his goal with Ukraine? What about Syria now? In October of 2015, the Washington Post reported that Russia had sent some of its top fighting units from Ukraine to Syria, supporting Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. And here's another question. What is the role of the United States in Ukraine and the conflict there? What about NATO? At the University of Rochester, the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies has brought in a distinguished guest to address these issues and more. Their guest tonight is Major General Volodymyr Havrilov, defense attaché of Ukraine in the United States. Now, Major General Havrilov began his military career in 1981 in air defense. In 1991, he joined the Ukrainian Armed Forces and has had tours as an attaché in the UK, Romania, and the United States. And he's our guest for the hour here on Connections. Major General Havrilov, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And also with us is Randy Stone, director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Randy, welcome back. Just give our listeners a little snapshot of what's going on tonight at 7:30.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be here. Major General Volodymyr Havrilov is going to be speaking at 7:30 in the Gergen Hall, and it's free and open to the public, and we look forward to your questions. And if you're intrigued by what you hear this hour, you might want to come see us tonight.
Well, there's a lot
parking is free, I should add, on the river campus at 7:30, so you can park anywhere.
Gergen Hall, 7:30 tonight. Now, there's a lot of different directions we can go, but I guess what I want to do is back up and ask our guest to begin by telling us your role here in the United States as a defense attaché. Tell us about what that role entails.
Well, first of all, I'm here for more than 2 years. I came to the United States just in the middle of conflict in the east of Ukraine. And my mission is to represent the armed forces of Ukraine here in the United States and assist to all efforts and means to our military, first of all, with training, with equipment, with understanding what is going on in Ukraine for others. And also, first time maybe in my career, I faced a problem of wounded soldiers from Ukraine, which also attended some military medical centers in the United States, and part of my mission was related to them.
Is part of your job lobbying the United States for more support in what's happening in Ukraine?
Part of my job is just to make American government and Congress aware of what is going on in Ukraine and what efforts have been done by our military leadership to strengthen our capability, and what problems we have, for example, with equipment and others to address the aggression of Russians on our east border.
Now, in the eastern part of the country, I'll turn back to Professor Stone just for a moment, because you've been on the program numerous times talking about Crimea and understanding what's happening in eastern Ukraine. Many more conversations we had in 2014, 2015, fewer since then, and I think it's important to get an update on at least how you perceive the conflict, and then I think we'll be able to speak in depth with the Major General Havrilov about that. For our listeners who are sort of maybe not as up to speed about what was happening, and the concern was this, you know, this part of Ukraine in the east where there were some pro-Russian demonstrations and, of course, some intervention by Putin. What's the latest as you see it there, and how do you see the conflict now?
Okay, well, in 2014, there was a lot of uncertainty. That was when, in the summer, Russia seized Crimea and then declared that was now a part of Russia in violation of international law that hasn't been broadly acknowledged by other countries, then I think Putin has made a series of mistakes and has been trying to recover from these mistakes by raising the stakes. And so having seized this one part of Ukraine, you know, that was an area that was consistently pro-Russian, right? And that where a lot of votes for the pro-Russian faction in the Ukrainian government came. So he realized the Ukrainian government would be less pro-Russian than it had been up until then. And of course, there's the issue of the territorial dispute, which will be an ongoing irritant in their relations for the foreseeable future. So he then had to recover from that by figuring out, how can I create new leverage over Ukraine? Well, I can do that if I create a new ongoing problem for Ukraine in eastern, in the districts of Donetsk and Luhansk. So this was, I think, very deliberate strategy. And it was done by, for the most part, off-duty Russian army officers and soldiers who were paid considerably more than their usual pay in order to volunteer, as you would in Ukraine, backed up by regular on-duty forces, and seized those two regions. For a while, it looked like the Russian advance might sweep all the way to Kiev, or that he might decide to annex a number of regions that went all the way to Crimea and create some kind of a continuous zone. And he seemed to be talking that way briefly. That was the heated part of the conflict. In September 2014, there was an agreement, the Minsk I agreement, which briefly created an armistice. Then that was between Ukraine and Russia and moderated by France and Germany. But then that almost immediately broke down. There was more fighting throughout the fall. And then there was another agreement in January 2015, which is called Minsk II. And it created a roadmap to a settlement, which would involve exchanging prisoners and pulling Russian forces out of Ukraine, and some kind of decentralization agreement that Ukraine would take on. That, again, didn't last very long. It broke down almost immediately. Fighting continued. And it's been on and off since then, with sort of continuous or almost continuous casualties, particularly on the Ukrainian side. I think the last thing I saw was about 3 Ukrainian soldiers dying per week on average over some period of
still
recently.
Still today.
Yes, so it's still ongoing conflict. Over 10,000 casualties in this conflict, which continues. And it could flare up at any moment. And Putin, I think, is using that as leverage over the Ukrainian government to kind of bludgeon them into accepting, in the long run, his vision for what Ukraine should be, which I think is not acceptable to the Ukrainian population.
Major General Havrilov, where were you in 2014, 2015? Were you in that part of Ukraine in the east?
In 2015, I was there. And, of course, I can compare with changes which we really achieved in 2016, also over there. But once again, we started that conflict with almost zero capability in terms of readiness of the executive branch or military power. And only during 2014-15, we started to really contribute a lot to strengthen our capacity and capability to withstand that problem in the east of Ukraine. The huge miscalculation of Putin was he underestimated the civil society in Ukraine, first of all. Then there was a lack of pro-Russian sentiments in the southern and southeast areas of Ukraine. He really expected that will be a kind of uprising of people in support of Russian world ambition up to from Crimea to Odessa and other areas. But he underestimated the civil society in Ukraine, which is different in mentality different in values comparing with the Russian society. So when you see the aggression on your territory, you immediately switch from your internal problems, political problems or economical problems, to the way how to defend, to protect your country and how to defeat the enemy. So I remember 22nd February 2014. In one day, Ukraine lost all executive branch. In the morning, people couldn't find Minister of Defense, President, Prime Minister, Minister of Internal Affairs, Chief of Security Service. All of them fled to Russia. The only legitimate body at the time was the Parliament of Ukraine. And Russia started to move to Crimea, to east of Ukraine. And the army was not ready because of the lack of the leadership, not ready with equipment. And only civil society, they send volunteers, they send people from different areas of life, from teachers, businessmen, and others, who took the arms from military and moved to east of Ukraine to assist weak units to protect the territories. Similar like here in the United States in 1812, when British Corps moved near Washington, from Washington to Baltimore.
Right.
The same farmers, from without any orders from the top, they defended, they protected the country.
Similar situation. So I want to ask you what you think Putin's goal, if he is going to be successful, is, especially as it pertains to what we now see with Crimea. If we had some conversations when the action in Crimea was happening in 2014, in which a number of people who have observed Putin for a long time, and I think Randy included, thought, you know, Crimea was valuable to Putin as a threat, less so if he actually seized it, because the threat of action is a powerful tool, as opposed to acting and then having to deal with the consequences and no longer having that. And I wonder, so I think there was some surprise, and I see Randy now, if I'm probably oversimplifying, but at least trying to recall conversations of the time.
No, that was the argument that I made at the time. That's right.
Okay. And certainly not just Randy making that argument, but is there also a thought that Putin doesn't really want to seize eastern parts of Ukraine, or does he, if he could, you think, want control also of what's happening, of regions in eastern Ukraine?
Events in Ukraine, in Kyiv, in autumn 2013 and during the winter of 2014, become a real surprise to Russia. Because once again, they didn't expect that kind of reaction from the civil society in Ukraine to the corrupted acts of the government and the president, former president of Ukraine. So and they were very disturbed to see the quick defeat of the central power by people from the street. They were very, very disturbed to see how the simple people can change the power in the country, especially in the country like Ukraine, which is similar with history, culture to Russia. So for him, what was a huge surprise and great danger. And he, at the beginning, understand in Moscow, they couldn't understand what is going on, who is behind that events. And they started to blame Western countries, United States, for contributing to that, to paying to protesters like that. For them, they couldn't accept that there are people ready to die for something just without any kind of money. But he still considered it as a very isolated event in Kyiv, in the capital of Ukraine, and maybe some other Western cities. And he understood that there is a pro-Russian sentiments in the rest of the country, and people are ready to change that situation to favorable for Russia course. But Crimea, of course, is a separate issue. I'm not going to touch it because he decided to do it quickly. I understand in Russia they were afraid that NATO countries will take care of this opportunity and they will move the forces next to Russia like that. East Ukraine, at the beginning, it was a mixture of local pro-Russian elements and some proxy from Russia as well. Later, they moved regular troops inside as well. But they never expected that there will be no reaction in the rest of the southern and eastern Ukraine. Not enough reaction to Russian acts in East Ukraine. That was a problem for Putin. After that, he was in the situation where there were no exit. He has to continue to do something. And now when the situation stopped and there is no way to achieve his goals in Ukraine by military force, of course, he switched to other methods. Some people call it hybrid or asymmetric. It's more related to corruption. Economic means, information warfare, things like that, trying to blow up Ukrainian society from inside and maybe to do something on this regard. But once again, they don't understand the real dynamics of changes in Ukraine. They don't understand that the new generation is coming to life. They don't understand that these young people who took part in active defense of the country in 2014, 2016, they will be in power in next 10, 15 years. They will be leaders of Ukraine. And they will never forgive for next 20 years what Russia done to them. So that is the check and balances which keep Ukrainian society very stable and strong in face of Russian aggression. And there is no way for Russia to defeat it.
You wrote a piece for the Cypher Brief Online analyzing how Putin and Russia deploy tactics in eastern Ukraine. But in reading the piece, there's been plenty of discussion in this country about maybe Putin, but Russia's tactics regarding international elections, including ours. And I couldn't help but feel that there were some similarity on at least the last two of the 4 points of something that you call Maskirovka. How do you pronounce it?
Correct, Maskirovka.
Maskirovka. How do you define what Maskirovka is?
It's a set of means how to cover your actions. It's a widely used military terminology. It's normal in the military and during any operations on tactical operational level to deceive the enemy, to create a kind of unpredictable situation like that. So for Russian military, it's a normal way of doing business. But with application of that approach on political level and other countries, it's almost different story because you live in the world of respected personalities or countries. And if you use that kind of methods in trying to achieve your goals in a civilized world, you can see almost different reactions, not like in operations on tactic levels and military.
You're very optimistic in saying so, but let me go ahead and read for the listeners. So again, what we're really talking about Maskirovka is not just sort of esoteric in eastern Ukraine. It is a, as the Major General said, it's a concept of trying to confuse the enemy and cover up true intentions. And so he listed 4 points in his piece. Number one, concealment or camouflage of military assets and positions with consequent measures to prevent a leak of information about them. In eastern Ukraine, I assume that that relates to many things regarding military assets, including just kind of unmarked soldiers. Soldiers aren't in uniform, et cetera. It's just one small example. Number two, simulation of false objects and activities. Number three, distractive activities and maneuvers to draw an enemy's attention away from one's true intentions. And number four, disinformation operations. That, am I making too big a leap to say that what Maskirovka looked like in eastern Ukraine, take away the military assets, and that feels like what Americans are debating whether it happened in the 2016 election here?
Many similarities, right?
Many similarities. And so this is where I am a little optimistic, because you conclude the piece with sort of a warning for Putin that it doesn't always work out. So let me read from the piece, and I'll ask you to explain a little bit more. You write, quote, "It turned out that the application of the doctrine of Maskirovka in the modern international environment may have given Russia a temporary tactical advantage, but created substantial strategic problems. That includes a loss of trust, isolation, international sanctions, and the resulting economic decline and degradation of Russia's society. Ukraine has learned that the best way to prevent and preempt the successive Russian use of Maskarovka is to collect and disseminate, in real time, facts and evidence of Russian hybrid and illegal activities on foreign territories through use of modern information technologies. This strategy may also apply to Moscow's interference in the internal affairs and politics of Western countries. End quote. So when you say that the best way to prevent and preempt the success of this kind of disinformation campaign is to collect and disseminate in real time facts and evidence, that seems idealistic to a scale that Americans in 2018 are still trying to figure out what happened in 2016 in an election when what was happening in real time was people were just confused. And how is it too idealistic to say in real time, if you document this and disseminate this, we can cut this off? Is that realistic?
I can give you just recent example.
Okay.
Syria. You know the briefing of the Department of Defense. They on the day of the strike, after the strike, they say, we accept the increase of Russian disinformation activity about that subject. So we would like to give you as more information as possible in real time to be ready to understand what is going on. And they've done it next morning. Because after the strike in Syria, Russia, during the nighttime, they created a lot of stories, what are the real results of the strike, with 72 or 73 missiles from 105 shot down, with other stories that everything is okay. But in the morning, immediately, 9 o'clock in the morning, Pentagon started their conference, their briefing, with pictures from satellites, with reports from commanders, that all missiles, maybe one, two, I don't know, all missiles reached the targets, no casualties, no effective air defense protection at all. No effective results of Syrian air defense. So the Russian course of action, the Russian disinformation package existed only for one day because of that. If you read the news in Russia today, you will see that people don't care about what Russia told them on the day of the strike. They see the real picture. But the problem is for the Ministry of Defense of Russia, because it's their general announced about the losses of Tomahawk cruise missiles. How the society in Russia can trust him after that, in future, even if he would like to present the real, true numbers. It's all about trust. It's all about reliability of sources. And there is a problem for anybody who would like to try to do something with disinformation in this world.
Now, a cynic would say, that's the Ukrainian perspective. You would love for the Russian populace to distrust their own leaders, and that is too optimistic a viewpoint. Is that realistic? Do you think in real Russian civil society there is a distrust now of their own leadership?
No, Russian society is very ill in terms of information perception. It's because of the propaganda there. Propaganda works. And of course, we should not be very idealistic in terms of that people can change their views or opinions just because of some kind of things. They have very stable view of what is going on in the world, which is not possible to change quickly. But it's about the leadership. It's about the leadership. You can point to the leaders in Russia that you are liars, that you are using disinformation techniques. And it's about the trust from international community to Russia, to present Russia on this international arena as not a reliable partner. And for Putin and his entourage, it's important to be more or less respectful in this world. And he doesn't like to be blamed as a liar.
Let me turn to Randy on this to see if you agree that, because certainly there is, I'm looking at two different frameworks. Number one, on the international community, I certainly take the Major General's point. Vladimir Putin wants to be respected. He wants to be viewed with legitimacy. And the more he is exposed for having led misinformation campaigns, whether it's in eastern Ukraine in a military campaign, in international elections, tampering, or whatever term you'd want to use, that could undermine him in the international community. But within his own country, do you agree, do you accept that at least some significant part of the Russian population also sees that and is lacking trust in their own leadership now?
I think there's a significant portion of Russian civil society that is lacking trust in Putin and in whatever comes from the Russian government. I think Russian public opinion is bifurcated. There are those who watch official television and get most of their news that way, and they're pretty unsophisticated, and they vote very substantially for Putin in United Russia. And then there is the more worldly elite in Moscow and St. Petersburg who tend to have more liberal values and have access to a much wider set of news sources, who the younger generation of that group speaks English very well and gets a lot of their news from the internet. There's still an element of cynicism in their worldview that I think is very entrenched. And this, partly this is inherited from the Soviet experience, I think. Partly it's been drummed into them by the Putin regime. They're cynical about all sources of information. They don't believe their government. They don't believe our government. They assume everybody lies. They're not very impressed by the claim that, well, somebody lied. Well, of course. Everybody always lies. We don't believe anybody, which is unfortunate. That makes it difficult to communicate effectively. And the interesting thing is that although many of I interact regularly with a group of foreign policy experts who are the best informed of the Russian elites, and these young foreign policy experts who speak English better than I do will demonstrate on the one hand that they have access to all this information, and then they'll still believe key elements of the Russian propaganda line, which is so outlandish from our perspective. So it's amazing just how persuasive it seems to be even among the elite. If you keep saying something, you create a certain resonance somehow.
Certainly there is something toxic about having societies that don't trust anybody. Say, well, everybody lies. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we trust no information. Is that not part of the goal of Putin? To undermine trust in any sort of authority is probably a very good thing in their minds, because you may not trust me, but you don't trust anybody else, and now we're going to work on eroding that trust and building cynicism in Western countries.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's different from the situation that he would have faced as a KGB officer in the Soviet Union, where he faced a very credulous populace, right, that was prepared to believe an awful lot of Soviet propaganda. And then there was the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of that credulity. Right. And it came a time when anything that was espoused by the former regime must have been false. And so therefore, I remember people in 1990 asking me, well, there isn't really any poverty in America, is there? Right. You don't really have racism in America. And I had to say, well, unfortunately, a lot of the things that you were told have a lot of basis in fact, but they were spun in creative ways. Right. The first best would be that they believe him and they don't believe anybody else, right? But that's impossible, right? Because there's too much information out there. So the best he can accomplish, given the mendacity of his regime, is to just kind of pollute the waters so that he can even everything out. It's not a competitive advantage then for the West to be the purveyors of truth.
That is a dark picture. Mm-hmm. And Major General Havrilov, let me ask you a hypothetical. I wonder if this conversation has happened. Let's say the American government calls you and says, look, as the defense attaché for Ukraine, who understands Putin and his tactics pretty well here, what can we do to better act in real time? Or do you think the United States is better acting in real time, whether it's in Syria, whether it's in elections and understanding, perhaps cyber kind of warfare of various kinds? What would you say to the United States?
First of all, of course, I am not a judge on internal United States policies and activities. I only can speculate on international activities and relationship. As to Ukraine, we have a great partner as the United States. The only country, I think, which really tried to understand at the beginning what was going on in Ukraine, and later provided us with a number of instruments and other things to assist us. Maybe not on the scale which we would like to get, but nevertheless, given the political situation here and other things, it was the most possible assistance and support from United States in 2014 and until now. We have a great support in Congress, bipartisan support for Ukraine, with all necessary bills, acts, and ideas approved by both parties. We have a great relationship with Department of Defense and Armed Forces of United States, which send us instructors. We have up to several hundred instructors from United States, including New York State National Guard, which is now in the west of Ukraine, assisting us with training our military. We have also decision made on lethal equipment for Ukraine, recently made by the administration of the current president. And we expect even other things to be done. So I think the most important thing we expect from administration of United States and America as well is to continue to push Russia with sanctions, to keep them stronger and stronger, those sanctions. And this morning I understand a new being introduced, not because of Ukraine, but because of Syria, but nevertheless.
New sanctions?
New sanctions, right. Yes. And Russia is very vulnerable in this regard. So their resources are limited. It's not a Soviet Union. The GDP is less than the California state, for example. So they're very vulnerable to that kind of things. In combination with the support of Ukraine in defense and security issue and in sanctions against Russia, I think Russia will not be in a long position to withstand this crisis.
All right, we have to take our only break. James in Fairport on the line, stay there. We'll get your question when we come back. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can do that by calling toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-TALK. 295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Our guests in studio include Major General Volodymyr Havrilov, who's defense attaché of Ukraine in the United States. Randy Stone is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester, and they have brought the Major General here to Rochester for an event tonight. Tonight, 7:30 at Gergen Hall at the University of Rochester, free and open to the public. The Major General is going to be discussing a number of events, including Ukraine's past events, the current challenges, and future outlook. And we're spending a good portion of this hour understanding his experience, analyzing the actions of Vladimir Putin in eastern Ukraine, Syria, and more. So we'll get that break. We'll come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, we mark 100 years since the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. And if your first thought is, okay, that's ancient history, so what? Researchers say it is almost certain that another pandemic like that will happen again eventually. What have we learned in the intervening 100 years? What have we learned since the flu killed more people than the Black Death in the Middle Ages? We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I've said a number of times that Professor Stone and the Skolny Center have brought the Major General here to Rochester, but it's a big event in a number of different organizations. It's sponsored by the Skolny Center, the Ukrainian Federal Credit Union, the Ukrainian American Community Foundation, the Rochester Ukrainian Group, and Rochester Global Connections. So a lot of different groups working together for tonight's event, which is free and open to the public, starting at 7:30 tonight. Let's get James in Fairport. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. And at the very start, have no illusions. I have great sympathy for the Ukrainians and what they've gone through under Stalin, and for their own international issues between the Western Ukrainians who have been touching Western Europe and part of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy versus the people who've been part of the Russian Empire for centuries. But my question to all of you, or to your two guests, is how do you address, rather than this real-time stuff and, you know, beating up on Putin or Putin beating up on somebody, which are maybe sounds pugilistic and fun, but the long-term strategic interests of Russia. And when I look at the Crimea in particular, 90% Russian, the home of its only warm water port, the center of its naval operations for the entire world, you know, I mean, maybe not for Vladivostok, but certainly for the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. And we had an agreement, the United States, and this is why I feel badly for the Ukrainians. The United States made a commitment that they would not bring the Ukraine, bring NATO to the Russian border. When the nationalists, the new, bright, young nationalists, took control in the Ukraine, they applied for NATO membership. NATO membership is impossible if you have foreign non-NATO members on your soil. Every diplomat and every general knows that. So in offering that and in accepting that, even if it's a long-term prospect, the Russians saw a very fundamental strategic interest threatened. And it should have, I'm sure it did not surprise the general. It should not have surprised any thinking European, and certainly the Germans were not surprised, that they would retake the Crimea, which was really only cosmetically given to the Ukraine by Khrushchev in the 1950s. So, and on top of that, the nationalists, as they always do in any country, they're on top and they started restricting the autonomy of the Russian speakers in Crimea. Putin, therefore, did nothing more than what any, in my view, any other Russian leader would have done. The United States does not have that kind of strategic interest, and the people who are duped are the Ukrainians who believe that we might. Russia will conduct full-fledged war over the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine and the Crimea, and the United States will not. So what do they think?
James, stay there. There's a lot there, and I'm going to start with Major General Havrilov. You can take it from whatever point you want there. Go ahead, Major General.
Well, I understand your position regarding the Crimea assessment. But once again, it's not about Crimea now. Crimea is a territory of Ukraine temporarily occupied by Russia, first of all. It was a great mistake of Putin to do that. Because you mentioned the strategic fundamentals, but strategic fundamentals not about the basis in Crimea or NATO. Strategic complications are for Russia in terms of survival as a nation. As a nation, they have to survive as an economically sustained, not isolated country. They have to do something with the internal things like that. So for them now, not the Crimea, but the success of Ukraine, economical, democratic, and others, that is a great threat to Russia now. So in terms of time, it's only a matter of time when Ukraine becomes strong and independent and will present the positive case for Russian people. Because if Ukraine succeeds with internal reform, with strengthening the institutions inside the country, and become a real military deterrence factor in East and Central Ukraine, the next question will be among Russian population to their leaders. Why? Why Ukrainians succeeded to do that? And why we are still there where we are in 19th and 20th century? That is a strategic fundamental problem for Russia, not Crimea. Crimea is a temporary event which I think sooner or later will be resolved, but it would be related to the destiny of Russia itself.
Okay, Randy, do you want to weigh in as well? And then we'll turn back to James. Go ahead, Randy.
Well, I just wanted to react to one thing that James said. I mean, I think that you're correct, James, that Russia is very much focused on kind of a sense of an existential threat and a fear of NATO expansion. But it's not accurate that the decisions in 2014 were were in response to a threat of NATO expansion, because there wasn't really any threat of NATO expansion on the table in 2014. Putin's sort of overreaction on Ukraine started with a free trade agreement between the EU and Ukraine, which was threatening to some of his cronies as they lose business opportunities in Ukraine and so forth. But it didn't have a strategic component. I think that it has subsequently become much more realistic that Ukraine might ultimately become a member of NATO because of Russian actions. And Russia is, motivated in part in what it's doing in eastern Ukraine in order to prevent the preconditions from arising where Ukraine could turn into a NATO ally. But I don't think that was on the table at all in 2014.
Okay. James, do you want to follow up? Go ahead.
I would only say I think that we as Americans tend to have shorter time spans, so it wasn't on the table now, but that 20-year lease that the Russians had for the Crimea with Ukraine, Europeans think in longer terms, and we sometimes, so I would suggest to the professor that maybe we need to understand that some people don't think in, 24-hour news cycles, but they think of where am I going to be on the chess on the chessboard in 20 or 30 years. So the other point is, I think the professor is absolutely right when it comes to the economic issue. And unfortunately for the Ukrainians, Putin can legitimately, if you will, remain spokesman for the huge ethnic Russian minority in the East. And it's very hard to determine whether they feel Ukrainian or feel Russian. So I wouldn't dispute what the professor said on that particular point, but the corporate entity that's going to have to bear the burden of all this will ultimately be the Ukrainians, and I think they need to find a solution with us in the background. But we've got to face the reality that we're not going to go to war over the eastern Ukraine.
James, thanks for the phone call. Randy, he addressed the idea that maybe you're looking too short-term. I've never thought of you as someone who's assuming the world, that you see the world through a 24-hour news cycle, but what would you say to the question of timescales that he brings up?
It's definitely true that this is always in the background for Russia, and they think of this as a long-term strategic threat. As long as they can't dominate Ukraine, they're afraid that somehow it's going to end up allied with the West, and that certainly is central in their thinking. I just wanted to be clear that we don't excuse Putin's moves as somehow a reaction to a threat from the West, right? Because there wasn't any threat from the West at that point. He provoked these series of events through his mistakes.
Okay, and Major General Havrilov, he talked about ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine and Putin being sort of a spokesperson for them and that there will continue to be these tensions. Do you see a path towards a more peaceful, sort of stabilized future in eastern Ukraine with the same borders as there are now, knowing that the farther east you go in Ukraine, the more you have that sort of mix of sentiment?
And there is a great understanding among all, even including Russia, Russian elite, that in case of withdrawal of Russian troops from east of Ukraine, the conflict will over very soon, weeks, because only because of the Russian presence there is a problem. About the ethnicity, language, and other things, it's a great illusion now that language or ethnicity is a kind of crucial factor in Ukraine. Ukrainian society is built now on values, not on language, not on some kind of else. And you can see it if you visit the Eastern Front, the line of contact with Russia. You can visit any unit there, military unit, composed from different people from different parts of Ukraine. They speak different languages. Sometimes many speak Russian, no problem. Ukrainian language you can hear. You can hear even languages of some minorities from west of Ukraine. So it's not the problem. It's about the values. It was important maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago. But now, when Russia crossed the red line of applying force in east of Ukraine, in trying to take our territories, they united Ukraine in terms of values and the importance of the sovereignty, independence, and freedom.
Professor Stone, I just want to add one more thought to this and get your take on this. There are more conversations that I've seen, certainly in my lifetime, about multiculturalism and its viability in many, many places. This country, I just got back from a trip to Spain, was in Barcelona, where there, of course, a separation movement, and had some very interesting conversation. I'm thinking about Eastern Ukraine, and I feel like there's two, well, there's a lot of schools of thoughts, but there's two important ones to really kind of take a look at. Number one, multiculturally, is there sort of this, is there a move towards strife in multicultural societies, or is it, and this is where I'm going to betray my own allegiance to the second idea, having conversations with Spaniards, with Barcelonians, their view is that we could have just done this together, but it's the leadership that loves to pit other against other. So it's Putin in eastern Ukraine, whereas Major General Havrilov is telling us, no, it's a myth that they can't live together. That, yes, there's different languages and maybe different ethnicities, but yes, they can live together, and that could be settled within weeks if we see the troops leave. I heard very similar ideas in Barcelona. I heard it in Madrid, this idea that, well, the national government is pitting us against a regional government, and the regional parliament is doing the same against the national. Do you believe that the world is sort of having this important reexamination of multiculturalism, and is it more typical that corrupt political actors take advantage of our differences to pit us against each other, as opposed to really we can't live together?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I want to make a sweeping claim about how this is going in some world historical sense, but I think there are forces that are leading to rewarding countries that celebrate their multiculturalism. Globalization certainly creates incentives in that direction. And I think it's true that where you see ethnic conflict, it's usually because there's a narrow elite that can take economic advantage of it. You certainly would see that, for example, in former Yugoslavia, right, which was a success of multiculturalism up until the point when chaos emerged, and then certain elites were able to mobilize along those lines and use it for their own personal advantage. I think you see that in America today, that the society is becoming more and more willing and eager to embrace diversity, but there are some political leaders who can take advantage of divisions and create fear and build a political base.
Very interesting.
Around that.
What are you most looking forward to with tonight's talk, Randy?
Well, I'm very looking forward to the opportunity for the Rochester community to ask Major General Havrilov some questions. And I think there are just all sorts of things about what's actually happening on the ground in Ukraine that we have a lot of curiosity about. We also have visitors from the Open World Forum, so there will be half a dozen Ukrainians who represent various educational institutions that have been driven out of those eastern Ukrainian provinces and have moved their universities and so forth to other parts of Ukraine. And so they're here to tell their story, and that should be very interesting as well.
Well, I'll be totally unfair to the Major General. I'll ask Ralph's question via email. He wanted a very simple, probably just a very simple question. What does Putin want in Syria? We've got about 90 seconds. What would you tell Ralph, who's emailed the program? What do your guests think that Putin really wants in Syria? Major General?
He wants a kind of victory to be presented to his people. What kind of victory doesn't matter. He wants to be a victorious leader. He wants to present his legitimacy in the right victorious way. So Syria for him, of course, there is a sentiment related to history, Soviet Union, other things. But nevertheless, now he is in situation when he is looking for the way how to present his withdrawal from Syria in victorious way.
Do you agree with that, Randy?
I think it started as a maskarovka, as an effort to try to distract from what was going on in Ukraine. And now he's gotten deeper and deeper and invested more prestige. And so it's going to be difficult for him to withdraw. He now has to show that he's successful. And it's awfully hard to show you're successful in the Middle East.
Boy, how are you going to extract any kind of ostensible victory there?
That's right. That's a really extraordinarily difficult, and it's, you know, such a morally compromised position. I think the Russian population is going to realize that this was yet another blunder. It just will take a little while.
Our thanks to our guest for the hour. Randy Stone is director of the Skelny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester, a frequent guest, and I know that very eager to have the event tonight. It's 7:30 tonight, free and open to the public. There is plenty of parking. That's at Gergen Hall, and that's at the University of Rochester, and looking forward to that. Thanks for taking the time to come in here today, Randy.
Thanks, Evan.
And our thanks as well to Major General Volodymyr Havrilov, Defense Attaché of Ukraine in the United States. Thank you for making the time for this program. We appreciate your expertise and your insight.
Thank you for having me.
All right, short break, more connections coming up.